This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. An investigative piece ran over the weekend in Tucson's Arizona Daily Star newspaper. Reporters spoke to a number of former members of the Faith Christian Church on the University of Arizona campus who say the group operates as a cult. Joining me now is investigative reporter Emily Bragel. She co-wrote the story. Emily, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Emily, give us a little background, would you please? What is the Faith Christian Church? How long has it been on the U of A campus?
Faith Christian Church, under its current name, has been on U of A's campus since 1990. The church actually existed here before that time as Maranatha Church. It was an offshoot of Maranatha based in Florida, which was a national group of churches that all focused on recruiting on university campuses. And Maranatha shut down in 1990, in part, many say, related to allegations that they were authoritarian and could have negative impacts on the students they were recruiting.
Mm. Now, you and your colleagues spoke to more than 20 former employees and church members. What started you down this path?
We first heard from a mom in Los Angeles whose son is a junior at the U of A right now, and he had gotten deeply involved in Faith Christian Church over the past couple of years, and the mom said she was getting really concerned about him. He'd changed his career plans and intended to join the church after college and become a campus minister, and had completely changed his personality and behavior, and she was actually worried that she would lose touch with him completely. So I spoke with her a few weeks ago, and when we began looking into this, very quickly we were able to find many other former members and including former staff members of the church who had just strikingly similar experiences. They echoed each other in so many ways. So we very quickly realized there was a big story there.
And what were some of the things the former church members told you that that were consistent?
One thing that came up repeatedly was this idea of complete submission to church leadership. People said that they were shamed if there was any questioning of church leadership. There was financial coercion during Bible studies. People would be asked to bring information on their personal bank accounts, which they said was for leaders to be able to ensure they were tithing enough. There's also shunning of anyone who leaves the church. They would lose all their friends if they decided to leave and couldn't be in contact with the church anymore. And also alienation from parents, complete control over one's time and activities, including down to what your college major should be, what kind of car you should buy. Just so many of these things were consistent from people we talked to who are now living across the country.
How were church leaders able to draw on the former members you spoke with? Did it sound as if certain vulnerabilities were being targeted?
That is exactly what we heard from the former members and a number. We spoke to nine different parents of former members as well. And it does seem that transition times are when people are particularly vulnerable to things like this. And the church does focus on college-age students. They're very upfront with that. It's part of their tactic, they say. So a lot of these former members we talked to said they were in a vulnerable time, both because they were in a new city, had no friends, were a freshman at college, or maybe were going through some personal challenges and had a terrible breakup, and many of them said were in a vulnerable place.
You reached out to church leaders to get their response. Did you ever get a reply?
We have not gotten any reply from church leaders, and that includes Steve Hall, who is the senior pastor there, and Ann Lax, the executive pastor. And we made a lot of efforts. We sent an email with 42 detailed questions outlining all of the allegations that we included in our story. We emailed those February 23rd, and then the next day I actually hand-delivered copies of those to Mr. Lax and Mr. Hall's homes, and we snail-mailed a copy of those questions to the church's P.O. box.
Emily, finally, how did the U of A respond to what the former church members had told you? Were they alarmed by what they were hearing?
They have responded now. They have said that in the past, although they'd heard about the church, they had not gotten any formal written complaints that involved a current student. And they said they couldn't undertake a formal investigation and really do anything about it until that happened. The Los Angeles-based mom who I spoke with has issued that or submitted that written complaint. So they are now taking action to look into the church. And if they do find that the church compromises students' experiences, that could be because clubs on campus have to have a positive experience for students. So that could be a basis for them limiting their activities on campus. But the university has been wary of doing anything that could be perceived as discriminatory of any group that comes on campus.
Emily Bragel, investigative reporter for the Arizona Daily Star. She and a colleague wrote about the Faith Christian Church on the U of A campus. Emily, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Now I'm joined by Nori Muster, author of Betrayal of the Spirit. Nori, thanks very much for being with us this morning.
Thanks, Steve.
Now, Nori, your experience with a group that some may describe as a cult, how did you get involved and what got you out?
Coincidentally, I was recruited on my college campus. The group was the Hare Krishnas. They were based in Los Angeles, and they opened a preaching center in Isla Vista, which was the college town for UCSB. And I was a really eager joiner, though. I wasn't. I didn't think I'd join anything. I thought I was going to finish college and go on to a career and do other things and just sort of have more faith. But the person who recruited me convinced me that that wasn't possible. In order to be on the path, I would have to join the temple and become a full-time member.
Wow. So how long were you in, and what eventually got you out?
I was in it for 10 years.
Wow.
I know. But the thing that finally made me leave was when I started to realize there was something going on in the organization that they were hiding. And that's what causes doubts in a lot of members. They start to get doubts. They start to see that their guru has clay feet. They start to see that the organization's got problems. And then they back away from it.
And there are families that actively want to get their loved ones out, but ultimately does it have to come down to the person, him or herself, to decide this is enough?
Yeah, some people will do an intervention with their children to try to get them out, and I don't recommend that. I've met people that have been through that who say it worked, but it costs a lot of money, and then it takes away the young person's or the cult member's liberty, really. That, you know, the decision is made for them. In my case, I waited. My father he lived really close to the temple, so I saw my father a lot. He got really involved with the group to try to stay in touch with me on behalf of the family. And he waited. He never said anything bad about the group until toward the end. We both started to have doubts, and we both started to see what was going on. And one day he just said, you know, you have a lot of weird men in your group, because we had been to the Venice Beach Festival. And I was like, you know, you're right, Dad. And we talked it out. He didn't try to force me to leave.
How scary is it, though, or could it be for parents who are so afraid of losing their child even more to sort of let nature take its course?
Yeah, my dad was a really patient, kind of unusual, unique person. But it is really scary for families because it's like their loved one has died. Yeah. The non-cult family can't understand what's going on. Their loved one is talking with all kinds of weird cult rhetoric. They don't speak English anymore. They get this glazed look in their eye. It happened to me. I was like that.
Fred, as someone who's been in and out, do you understand when people who are not in sort of think, boy, how did you get sucked into that? Why were you in it?
Yeah, well, I have a lot of regrets. If I could do it over, I don't know, I might do it over. I had some good experiences, too. I've been out for 26 years, and it shaped my life. It marked my life. And then I wrote a memoir about it, which marks your life even more, because now we have Google, and anyone who puts my name in the search engine will come up with my whole resume. But my whole dream was to become an online teacher once the internet came out, and now I work at Mesa College at teaching real estate online.
Okay.
So I have been able to overcome that stigma, but it was really hard. I mean, I applied for a lot of jobs teaching, and I think they would Google me and just like, she's a Manson girl.
Wow.
You know?
It's Here and Now in KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix talking with Nori Muster about cults. Nori, how do you define what a cult is? And from your perspective, at least, are all cults inherently dangerous?
Well, a cult, the word cult is really pejorative, and scholars don't like to use it because it's like pointing a finger if you call something a cult. So I use the word dangerous cult.
Okay.
Because that defines more clearly what I mean. Like you could say a cult was, you know, a homeowners association or a stamp collectors group or something. But a dangerous cult is defined by a charismatic leader who is not really a very good leader. He's immature or has other kind of motives, who gathers a bunch of people around him, controls them, gets a lot of gratification from having followers. And then I define a dangerous cult by how deeply the group is into crime or abuse or emotional abuse or unethical behavior. So if it's a benign cult, a lot of religions are benign and a lot of groups are benign. You know, a good group is marked by, you know, allowing people to have individuality, make their own choices, good communication, clearly defined roles. People, you know, the thing about a cult is you go into it and you get stuck in it. And they take away your freedom. They use the word brainwashing, but again, that's another pejorative word that scholars don't like to use.
When it comes to dangerous cults, is there resentment, backlash that comes about toward the leader once a person has left a cult? Or at that point, is it just, I'm free of it, I'm not going to worry about it anymore?
It depends on the cult. Like Scientology, we don't want to get you guys in trouble, but if you leave Scientology, they will harass you. They'll search your garbage. They'll park in front of your house. Sometimes they send thugs I don't want to get you guys in trouble, but anyway.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. Some cults are worse than others. The group I was in was pretty nice to me when I left. They were actually glad when I left because I was writing their newspaper and they didn't like what I was saying about them. I was doing editorials and interviewing the leaders and doing all this kind of journalism they didn't like. They wanted it to just be a nice portrayal of the group, like a PR publication. So when I left, they were like, yay, goodbye. But then I wrote a book, so they, you know.
Nori, did dangerous cults, in the case of the leaders you're talking about, who are bad folks, at least to many, do they, those leaders themselves, consistently believe the message, or are they playing a role just to persuade others?
Oh, it depends. Some cult leaders start out really sincere, and they actually believe in what they're doing, but then they become really infatuated with themselves, they become narcissistic, and they lead the group off track. Other cult leaders start off just wanting power and money, and they're like psychopaths, you know, they'll do anything to anybody to get what they want. Mm-hmm. So it just depends on the group.
How much do you think this inherently just has to do with how we are as human beings and whether some people have vulnerabilities, others just want to feel like they're going to make their own choice and not have people tell them what to do, and ultimately things can get dangerous or not, depending on how a person can handle things?
Yeah, that goes back to the study of cults. People don't understand what a cult is. It's really just the dark side of human behavior. It's like on the playground. You have children. Hey, that's my ball. Give it back. I'm not going to play with you. You're bad. You know, that's the behavior. That's the level of behavior in a cult. That's the level the leaders are on. That's the followers, that's a whole mixed bag of who joins cults. But yeah, it's just bad human behavior, and then they call it a cult. Yeah. So, or identification with the aggressor is another way to put it.
Nori, last thought for you. Based on the studies you've done and the experience you've had, does it feel like cults are more or less prominent? Is it sort of the same as it's always been?
I think there's more cults, but they're smaller and lesser known. I think people learn, the big cults are still around, like the Unification Church and Scientology, Hare Krishna. They're still around, but people are a little more wary of them, but they'll join like this one in Tucson. They'll think, oh, well, it's a Christian group. It can't be bad. But cults will take any philosophy and just turn it into a poisonous thing.
Nori Muster is author of Betrayal of the Spirit. She's been talking with us about cults as a follow-up to an investigative piece that ran in the Arizona Daily Star newspaper in Tucson. Nori, thank you for coming in.
Oh, thank you, Steve.